The willingness to create such coalitions is a positive development. But Schwab's assertion that through transparency and monitoring, these efforts gain something like the legitimacy they might derive from having a genuine mandate is a bit of a rationalization. First, there are limitations on the transparency of the processes involved, whether they involve identifying priorities within the discussions at the forum or determining how plans will be followed through. Many players are, after all, private sector actors. Second, business groups tend to act in the interests of business. Consequently, if a coalition is dominated by business, they may do some good, sometimes a lot of good, but only to the extent that it serves their corporate interests. And that is why legitimate public governance mechanisms with real mandates are needed to set these priorities. Schwab has, through Davos, developed legions of supporters. The former Saudi Arabian ambassador to the United States, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, for example, says, "I recommend Davos not just for my government, but for my friends as well. I think when people get together, they tend to end up doing things together, and that is good. When you remove the barriers that politeness or civil practice impose on people and establish rapport with one or a group of people, you find that you turn to them when you have other ideas or you need to do something. I saw that in a group I co-chaired with them called the C100, the Council of 100 Leaders, created to promote dialogue between Western and Islamic worlds, which brought together people from inside and outside. And the forum was so important because you could tap into sources of funding at the conference you couldn't find anywhere else." Schwab also has his critics, of course, even among those who attend Davos. In my experience, you have to take such critiques with a grain of salt. There is much ego in these crowds, and sometimes a small snub or a failure to remain at the center of the Davos limelight from year to year is cause for unhappiness among the elites who attend. Nonetheless, there are legitimate issues raised in their criticisms. For example, one American who has been a top Wall Street executive and a high-level government official said to me, "I won't go to Davos unless I have to. I think it is awful, a tedious mob scene. But we are part of that world whether we like it or not. It's the liberal internationalist world. However, it has no real policy implications. It is a big show these days, and Klaus is a complicated businessman, the great P.T. Barnum of our time, and he has created in Davos the world's greatest Ponzi scheme." Philippe Bourguignon, a former co-CEO of the World Economic Forum, offered a more balanced view. "Davos plays this role in at least developing awareness among leaders, governments, and business people. Like HIV/AIDS or global warming. But I think today it has also become, in some ways, a big missed opportunity. It still clearly has a role, but this role could have a much greater impact. I wouldn't say it is bad, it has just missed a step. People like former French President Jacques Chirac look at Davos, and they see a club of rich global leaders whose only motivation is economics, business, and not human things. And he just hated it. He considered it a threat to France. Once we tried to get him together at the meeting with Lula, the Brazilian president, who wanted to do a dialogue at Davos with him on emerging country versus developed country issues. And we tried and tried, but Chirac just refused to go. Not only didn't he do it, he convinced Lula to meet with him outside of Davos 1 week after the meeting. It wasn't the substance of the issue he objected to. It was Davos." Bourguignon sees pockets of opportunity within the meeting, places where the hubbub of the big show is far away and real work can get done. For example, he says, there is a group in Davos called the International Business Council. They are especially interesting because it is a very good group, just the biggest business leaders. It is 100 people, but because it is only 100, the quality is high. Secondly, it is more of a global mix with America, Europe, Asia, and so on. Very global. And it has everything from pharmaceuticals to heavy industries through digital. and it produces some of the best discussion. By the way, I don't think that political leaders are less important at Davos just because economics is more important than politics. It is because the political leadership is just not as good. They don't get it, and therefore they have become less influential. One place where he has seen political leaders remain influential by using conventional tactics is China, where the forum tried to set up a meeting to address the glaring lack of Asian participation at Davos. The only problem was that the Chinese government absolutely refused to permit discussions about certain sensitive subjects. At first, because the forum would not capitulate, the Chinese created their own Davos, the Boao Forum. But later, the forum agreed to what one insider gently referred to as a more collaborative stance, and they formed a partnership that led to forum events and an office in China. Although, said one forum insider, the jury is still out on whether that will take, and that's really the biggest issue there is for the continued relevance of the forum in a world economy where so much has moved east. The Carlyle chairman and former IBM CEO Louis Gerstner told me, "I was a member of the Trilateral Commission and Bilderberg, but I never went to Davos." Some forums, like the Council on Foreign Relations or the America-China Society, these are very constructive, useful ways for you to share your views with people who have a common interest. It is just like going to a chess club or a bridge club. There are people who share a common interest, and you get a reward for contributing, for being part of it. But in a big meeting like Davos, I believe there is a very serious diminishing return. And I think that may be true at times for Trilateral and Bilderberg as well. What difference have they made? This sentiment was often echoed in my conversations. Bob Kimmitt, currently Deputy Secretary of the U.S. Treasury, said, "I have participated in almost every one of those events, and I find they are very, very useful settings for relationship building, for setting up bilateral meetings, to get a little bit away from the world of action to the world of ideas. The intersection between public and private sector at these events can be important. At Davos or Bilderberg and some of the others where people from both worlds get together, sometimes we can use those settings to help get things done, to help get the message across. But generally, we find the most effective way to get things done is to complement the public side of these events with bilateral meetings, with exchanges that are private. It is all about knowing how to use them and about keeping expectations at the right level." When Samuel Huntington coined the term Davos man, he was lamenting the emergence of an elite without a country. He described this group as having little need for national loyalty. They view national boundaries that thankfully are vanishing and see national governments as residues from the past whose only useful function is to facilitate the elite's global operations. Huntington's idea has evolved over time, and today it is often used in blogs, books, essays, and newspaper columns to describe not just global citizens, but a group intent on forcing its view of the world on everyone else. Sometimes it takes on a lighter context, emphasizing the social hobnobbing that goes on during the WEF meeting, as in an observation from the BBC, for example. And so they walk around, tie or no tie, to do what Davos man does best, networking and schmoozing. Not surprisingly, Davos and Davos man are both less and more than they are cut out to be. They are less in that Davos is a big, unfocused bazaar, full of a broad mix of people, sometimes extraordinarily powerful, some much less so, some leftover power players from past eras, some who must have come in via someone's luggage. Davos rarely produces big breakthrough events, and is, in truth, an unlikely venue, teeming as it is with reporters, for meetings of secret cabals. But Davos is also more, in that perhaps 500 to 1,000 of the people who attend truly are members of the global superclass. It is the largest gathering of them that takes place anywhere. It is also, thanks to the wonderful, obsessive, complex, and quirky brain of Klaus Schwab, a place where they don't just talk business. Sometimes his commitment to the notion that the forum really can improve the state of the world seems vaguely delusional, a kind of altitude-induced messianic dizzy spell that at times comes off as dilettantism. But social and spiritual issues are on the program, and they don't have to be. Yes, perhaps this is in part to calm the protesters and diffuse criticism. But the great power of this group, as we have seen, is not that of co-conspirators, but that of agenda setters. Bringing these issues to the attention of elites has gradually, palpably, helped change their agenda. The recent mainstreaming of AIDS and later global warming as widely held concerns are the two best examples. Davos is a phenomenon. Bustling, fascinating, boring, chaotic, important, gross, earnest, and proof that one man with vision and energy can make a difference. That it is growing a bit wheezy as Schwab nears retirement raises questions about its future, but Huntington and others were certainly right to note its significance in the early years of the global era. If Schwab hadn't invented it, somebody else certainly would have. Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission, two gatherings of old men. In fact, others have created important global forums, and many rival Davos or have at one time or another. Most are smaller and more exclusive. And today, as international meetings become commonplace among every group of leaders, many of the legendary ones are losing their sheen. Bilderberg in particular attracts a special breed of critics. An excerpt from the promotional materials associated with Bilderberger, The Timetable of the New World Order, 2006, by German author Andreas von Reitje, illustrates the genre, perhaps not as melodramatically as some others, but with a similar thrust. Our world history is not the result of coincidences, but rather precise planning. More than half a century ago, a powerful group was formed to take the fate of this planet into hand and steer the world in the direction of a secret brand of internationalism. Numerous crucial events in politics and economics can be traced back to subtle manipulation by Bilderberg. Their goal? Total global control. The high priests of globalization first met in 1954 under strictest secrecy for the first time in the Netherlands Hotel de Bilderberg. Since then, Bilderberg meets once a year in the most distinguished hotels of the world. What is discussed there behind locked doors remains strictly secret, but we have no choice. Whatever the Bilderberger decides will shape our future. They rank among the central organs of a worldwide shadow government. The annual meeting of the Bilderberg Group has provided ample fodder for conspiracy theorists since its founding by Dutch Prince Bernard in the mid-1950s. By 1964, it was accused of orchestrating support for socialist Gaston Defferre in the French presidential elections. In 1971, critics claimed that Bilderbergers had been given advanced notice of Nixon's new economic policy, which allowed them to make $20 billion in profits. And in 1974, critics charged the group with coordinating the military coup in Portugal. Bilderberg emerged in the 1950s as a private initiative by European political and business leaders who were concerned about America's commitment to Western Europe. The group was composed of business leaders, diplomats, academics, military chiefs, and senior government officials, reportedly including top-level members of the intelligence community. Bilderberg does its best to stay under the radar. There is no official Bilderberg website, and the BBC reported in 2004 that a phone call to the listed number for the Bilderberg Group, based in Leiden, Holland, yielded an anonymous voicemail message reciting back the number and giving no further information. The organization keeps the location of its annual meeting under wraps, and its participants, roughly 150, including a handful of journalists, are sworn to silence about what goes on inside. In 2006, the venue, Brook Street Hotel in the tiny town of Kanata in Ontario, Canada, was entirely shut down, barricaded by heavy metal gates, and swarming with police who had special issue Bilderberg passes. Even the security is secret. Local police told an Ottawa reporter that security was being handled by Global Risk Holdings. But when the reporter reached the president of GRH, he was told, "Never heard of that conference. What is it? What do they do?" Indeed, trying to break through the wall of secrecy has created a cottage industry of Bilderberg sleuths, from the British Tony Gosling to the American James Tucker, founder of American Free Press and author of Jim Tucker's Bilderberg Diary, the French Pierre and Danielle de Villemarest and William Wolfe, authors of Facts and Chronicles Denied to the Public, and the Belgian Geoffrey Guillens, author of Tout Pouvoir Confondu, All Powers Confounded, which contains an extensive history of Bilderberg. The four-day Bilderberg meeting in Kanata attracted the usual crowd of spectators and protesters, each with various theories about what was going on inside. Speculations about the group's agenda included world domination, a merger of Canada with the United States and Mexico, the suppression of technology for fuel-efficient cars, and hiding the cure for cancer. One protester, a filmmaker from Texas who claimed to have an insider source, shared his theory on Bilderberg. "It's a group of very powerful individuals whose objective is to create one world government," he said, "based on an economic model from the Middle Ages, a post-industrial model where you have slaves and slave owners." A fellow protester who had camped out at the hotel's entrance agreed that the high rollers inside were up to no good. "They're ruining our planet," he said. "They're suppressing free energy. They're forcing farmers to switch to genetically modified seeds. They want to control everyone. No freedom, no democracy." Contrary to the mystique and the mythologies surrounding the conference, former and current participants readily assert that Bilderberg does not in fact set the global agenda. Crap! Pronounced Lord Dennis Healy, one of the four founding members, when asked about the conspiracy theories. "There's absolutely nothing in it." One former senior U.S. official who has been a regular participant for more than a decade said that the Bilderberg meeting had far greater relevance when it was first established in the 1950s, but that it had since become worthless as far as affecting change. "There is nothing that happens at Bilderberg that affects events after Bilderberg," he said. Discussions with veteran Bilderbergers suggest that the group has become largely outdated and obsolete. Its members no longer represent the global power elite in the way they once did. Participating political leaders consist mostly of ministerial-level officials and former bureaucrats, while members from the business and finance community are, for the most part, CEOs of old-guard corporations and banks. Emerging power players in technology and new media are almost entirely absent. "None of the telecom giants come to Bilderberg," the former U.S. official confirmed. "None of these people would bother going. They'd say, 'Who are these old farts?'" The event is almost exclusively transatlantic, with rare representation from Asia, Latin America, the Middle East, or Africa. Victor Halberstadt, who has organized many of the meetings over the years as its secretary general and still works closely with the organization, denies that it has become merely a forum where influential people can regularly meet in a private setting and discuss issues of mutual interest. Halberstadt is one of those habitués of the elite world who literally know everyone. He cannot walk across the floor of the Congress Center in Davos without being stopped every moment, and yet he has maintained a sense of humor and proportion about it all. He is a special sort of figure among the members of the superclass, a node, a facilitator of connections, and one who has risen to a position of considerable influence and access as a consequence. He also serves on the Goldman Sachs International Advisory Board, on the supervisory boards of Koninklijke KPN, TNT, and Concertgebouw, and as a non-executive director of PA Holdings Limited, and RHJ International. "I find the world government accusations absolutely laughable," Halberstadt said. "For the past few decades, I have observed what happens in some of these rooms and corridors, the disagreements, the divisions. These conversations often serve a useful purpose. The world's history demonstrates the continuous appearance of many such forums. If they didn't exist, new informal clubs would immediately be created, as now happens through the web." Said one Bilderberg regular, "I've been to most of the last 12 meetings. It's nothing. It's a group of 120 very senior people. By senior, I mean old. I'm not joking about them being old, by the way. Rockefeller is in his 90s. The original idea of Bilderberg was a classic example of the power elite. A small number of Europeans and Americans would meet in total secrecy somewhere in the world when they really mattered and try to reach a consensus. That was in the 50s, and the consensus they tried to reach was within an existing framework of NATO and the Marshall Plan. Bilderberg and the Trilateral Commission are absolutely meaningless except as individual network opportunities. Oprah Winfrey has more influence than anyone who goes to Bilderberg at this point." The Trilateral Commission, another private policy group, has about 350 members from Western Europe, North America, and Pacific Asia, with a handful of triennium participants from other regions. It was founded in 1973 by David Rockefeller, who asserted the need for a forum in which to share European, American, and Japanese views. Rockefeller was chairman of the Council on Foreign Relations at the time, as well as chairman and CEO of Chase Manhattan Bank. Given these facts and his family history, it is small wonder that the group, created with the active help of future U.S. National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski, became a lightning rod for conspiracy theorists. Trilateral meetings were first held in 1975 and continue to this day, with the Japan leg of the group now expanded to include more countries from throughout the Asia-Pacific region. As of 2006, the chairmen were Tom Foley, the former U.S. Speaker of the House, Peter Sutherland, the former WTO Director General and chairman of both BP and Goldman Sachs International, and Yotaro Kobayashi, the chairman of Fuji Xerox. Former and current members comprise a wide range of former U.S. presidents, Federal Reserve governors, cabinet secretaries, senators, CEOs, bankers, journalists, academics, and their counterparts worldwide. Most of the attendees with whom I spoke were becoming gradually disenchanted with the group. Four different people called it an old men's club. "The Trilateral Commission is a joke," said one especially dismissive former member who was a senior official in several Republican U.S. administrations. "It's a bunch of has-beens who do not have power except to convene themselves and to feel a little bit more important because they convened themselves." The meetings, according to the official, consisted of useless presentations and levels of abstraction that are unconnected with reality. The Clinton Global Initiative and the Power of Global Philanthropy. If anything has rocked the world of elite gatherings and had a genuine impact in the past several years, it has been the Clinton Global Initiative, CGI. First convened in New York City in September of 2005, the event brought together business and government leaders and experts to discuss solutions to major world problems. It is a project of the William J. Clinton Foundation and former President Clinton, with a stated mission to increase the benefits and reduce the burdens of global interdependence, to make a world of more partners and fewer enemies, and to give more people the tools they need to build a better future. What has set CGI meetings apart is not the attendees, who look very much like the people you might find at Davos, but rather the approach. The objective is to promote action, to get participants actually to commit resources to solving problems. It addresses the core issue of action that Schwab cited as being so vital to legitimizing such an organization. In fact, Schwab's reference to that fact is no doubt a reflection of the importance he grants to the CGI. Several different executives of the World Economic Forum with whom I spoke said they felt Schwab saw the CGI as a potential threat, assuming perhaps more effectively a space that Davos had sought for itself as a gathering that formulates and affects global projects. Illustrating the power of the idea, during the 2006 event, participants made 215 pledges totaling $7.3 billion, all targeted toward problems, poverty, global warming, and pandemics, for example, that have been established as priorities by the CGI. The largest of these was a $3 billion commitment from Sir Richard Branson to direct a portion of the future profits from his transport business to fight global warming. Skeptics suggested that many of these commitments would have been made even without the catalytic role played by Clinton and his team, and others took particular aim at the Branson pledge as a non-commitment commitment, given that it was pledging as yet unearned profits, and it reserved the right of Branson to choose where the cash might go. Yet virtually everyone with whom I spoke sees the Clinton effort as a breakthrough and a big step away from the talk fests that most global conferences have become. The CGI is tapping into a particular gestalt, the rise of the new philanthropists and of a new era of engaged activism by some members of the superclass and big companies. This trend is also reflected in the establishment of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, combining $30 billion commitments from both Bill Gates and Warren Buffett, two of the world's richest men. This is not entirely an accident. Not only was Clinton the president who presided over the dot-com boom that made so many members of the new superclass rich, like Gates, and not only has he emerged as perhaps the world's most prominent advocate for what might be called enlightened globalization, but ties between the Clinton Global Initiative and the Gates Foundation include links between key leaders at Gates and the Clinton administration. The foundation's CFO, Alexander Friedman, was a White House fellow and Assistant Secretary of Defense, while its number two executive, Sylvia Matthews Burwell, served as Deputy White House Chief of Staff. Burwell was also a protege of the man whom many consider Gates' mentor on globalization, Bob Rubin, and initially worked for him in the Clinton administration. Thomas Friedman was effusive in his praise for the Clinton event. "This is as close as you will get to global government," he said. "I was thinking about it as I was looking around the room, and here you have these leaders from all over the world. And let's say Branson pledges $3 billion to fight global warming. That is really a government-level, government-size commitment. That is a form of transnational governance, and it is filling a void." "These things like Davos," he observed, "really started out as business networking. That was really the original impulse. But Klaus quickly realized that I have really got something here. I have created a form of global governance, and I can use it for a lot more than to help Microsoft and ING get rich. I can leverage this thing." And then Clinton sees that, and he does kind of his own offshoot under his own brand. And what he does is he gets your superclass into a room, and he gets them to sign commitments. I mean, literally, when you go, you see these guys come out and they sign a document. They actually go and take something big like a diploma, like a government declaration, and they sign it. Leading U.S. venture capitalist John Doerr goes up, and Richard Branson goes up, and they literally sign, "I will do this." It has the feeling of an act of law. In fact, John Doerr said a funny thing. He said to Clinton, "I am used to you signing the laws." "This could have been the UN," he continued. "They could have been countries signing, but the countries haven't stepped up. With some of these international issues, they aren't really in the position to do so politically. In fact, it is interesting to compare. The UN General Assembly was meeting at the same time as the CGI. Both were going on. Who did more?" UNGA, UN General Assembly, was a talking shop where Hugo Chavez was accusing the president, Bush, of being the devil, and Ahmadinejad was promoting his idea that the Holocaust was a myth. And meanwhile, the Clinton Global Initiative was enlisting government-level commitments from individuals in order to provide governance, in this case, social safety nets. Richard Holbrooke observed in kind, "Right now it is clear that Bill Clinton is the most influential private citizen in the world. You can like it or hate it. You can marvel at it or wring your hands at it. But he is astonishing right now. And on the issues I work on, AIDS, for example, he is making a huge impact." California's Superclass Summer Camp. Scores of events each year, from air shows to industry conferences, from award ceremonies to birthday parties of the very prominent, end up attracting members of the superclass. These elites do, after all, have more in common with each other than they do with anyone else, and they are constantly strengthening and refining the networks within their evolving universe. Even if the global superclass is defined as narrowly as we have defined it, a group of approximately 6,000 people, it is still large enough that most members know only a fraction of the others. Consequently, all these meetings are important nodes for connection, for sharing views, for shaping views, for setting agendas, and for making the connections that lead to deals or stronger coalitions to support their interests. They help ensure that chief executives and government leaders stay current with each other's views, and they help build consensus on issues from taxation to trade, to who is in and who is out. In fact, the constant assessing and reassessing of the relative positions of various members of the elite is, I have found, one of the favored pastimes at these events. Together, these assemblies help form the glue of the global community of leaders, providing the meeting halls and, as Mark Malik Brown put it, the village greens. In this regard, the Bohemian Grove is not a place of power, it's a place where the powerful relax and enjoy each other's company. As G. William Domhoff, a professor of sociology at UC Santa Cruz, which is located 150 miles from the Grove, puts it, "Despite the suspicions of many on the right and a few on the left, the Bohemian Grove is not a secret meeting place to plot, plan, or discuss. Everyone there is too drunk for that kind of thing anyhow." The motto of the club, "Weaving spiders come not here," comes from Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream and serves as an admonition against discussing business or other worldly concerns at the Grove. Members are instead encouraged to focus on the arts, literature, and other pleasures found within the portals of Bohemia. According to a recently revealed audio recording, one regular participant, the ever-colorful Richard Nixon, called it the most faggy goddamned thing you could ever imagine. The Grove, located on 2,700 acres of redwood forest in Northern California, is perhaps one of the most bizarre examples of an elite organization. For 2 weeks in late July, the camp is attended by around 1,500 all-male members of the Bohemian Club, a private social group founded in San Francisco in 1872. Press reports of the group are rare, since the ultra-secretive club shuns publicity. But by most accounts, the Grove is like summer camp for rich and powerful grown-ups. Because of its high-powered membership, recent guests from the current U.S. administration include Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Karl Rove, and George W. Bush, the group has also fueled its share of conspiracy theories. Critics on the left worry about political conspiracies and global policies plotted at the Grove, while critics on the right cite stories of homosexual rituals, devil worship, and child sacrifice. One of the most famous accounts of consequential happenings at the Grove identifies it as the site where the atomic bomb was first conceived and planned. According to Domhoff, the Grove's only atomic connection concerns a single member who asked the club president if he could use part of the camp during an off-season month to meet with other individuals involved in the Manhattan Project, none of whom were Bohemians. Membership at the Grove is highly selective and invitation only. Invitation begins with a ritual called the cremation of care, in which the Grove members burn an effigy to rid themselves of worldly concerns. This ceremony contained a twist in 1996 when George H.W. Bush, Clint Eastwood, and Walter Cronkite, playing the parts of lakeside frogs, croaked like the frogs in the famous Budweiser ads of the 1990s, substituting a tritone chant of cremation for Budweiser. The lakeside talks, occasional informal speeches at the Grove, have historically given politicians an important platform for self-promotion. As one bohemian put it back in 1963, "Well, of course, when a politician comes here, we all get to see him, and his stock in trade is his personality and his ideas." One particularly telling illustration of the importance of lakeside talks came with Richard Nixon's account of future President Dwight D. Eisenhower's appearance at the event. "In the summer of 1950, I saw him at even closer quarters at the Bohemian Grove." Nixon notes that, "After Eisenhower's speech, we went back to Caveman Camp and sat around the campfire appraising it. Everyone liked Eisenhower, but the feeling was that he had a long way to go before he would have the experience, the depth, and the understanding to be president. But it struck me forcibly that Eisenhower's personality and personal mystique had deeply impressed the skeptical and critical caveman audience." Nixon later claims that a speech he gave at the Grove may have catapulted him to the nation's highest office. "If I were to choose the speech that gave me the most pleasure and satisfaction in my political career, it would be my lakeside speech at the Bohemian Grove in July 1967. Because this speech traditionally was off the record, it received no publicity at the time. But in many important ways, it marked the first milestone on my road to the presidency." In 1995, then U.S. House Speaker Newt Gingrich and former President Bush delivered a lakeside talk. Bush reportedly spoke of how his son George W. would make a great president someday. As Domhoff notes, perhaps the most striking change in the lakeside talks in the 1990s was the absence of any Clinton administration officials. In previous years, cabinet members from Democratic administrations were prominent guests and lakeside speakers. Domhoff argues, "It is safe to say that the Bohemian Club's regular members are now solidly Republican." One attendee at the 2007 meeting found it relaxed and a little strange. He noted that the various talks were not that much different from those you would find at other conferences, but that the setting, including the occasional pin-up photo tacked to a wall and rather elaborate, heartfelt theatrical productions featuring participants, made it unusually relaxed and convivial, much more fun than any other meetings I've been to attended by the same people. The Grove boasts a telling blend of members from the political, financial, and business clusters of the American elite. From a list of the top 1,144 corporations in America, the sociologist Peter Phillips found that 24% had at least one director who was a member or guest in 1993. For the top 100 corporations outside of California, the figure was 42%. So while the vast majority of what goes on at the Grove is just fun and games, and a lot of drinking, it is inevitable that when elites get together, they will talk business. Domhoff notes that this sort of forced proximity breeds consensus, and he provides a social psychological perspective on elite gatherings. First, the very fact that rich men from all over the country gather in such close circumstances as the Bohemian Grove is evidence for the existence of a socially cohesive upper class. It demonstrates that many of these men do know each other, that they have face-to-face communications, and that they are a social network. In this sense, we are looking at the Bohemian Grove and other social retreats as a result of social processes that lead to class cohesion. But such institutions also can be viewed as facilitators of social ties. Once formed, these groups become another avenue by which the cohesiveness of the upper class is maintained. Even the more moderate of conspiracy theorists usually ascribe an exaggerated amount of coordination, coherence, and influence to the group they criticize. The individuals who take part in these institutions and who participate in certain elite events, clubs and conferences, and casual dinners probably do not have secret designs for world domination, but most likely do have common interests. They share similar goals and, in many cases, a similar view of the world and the direction it should take. In linking together with one another, they aim not to conspire as a group, but to enhance their own power by advantageous associations. For that reason, one finds that each sector, political, business, and military, has venues where its leaders gather and, in a sense, reassert their togetherness. Asian and Latin American wannabes or harbingers of the supermeetings of tomorrow.
The Boao Forum for Asia, BFA, was created as a regional alternative to the WEF in 1998 and has been attempting to hold comparable annual meetings in Hainan, China since 2002. It follows the same basic format. 1 to 2,000 elite participants, a hodgepodge of panel discussions, social gatherings, and other informal networking events. But by many accounts, the BFA has yet to achieve the same status and relevance as its European doppelganger. In 2006, the meetings lasted less than 48 hours, and other than a handful of current and former heads of state, there seemed to be a shortage of high-profile leaders and entrepreneurs. Such comparisons are not completely fair, of course, since the WEF has had a head start of nearly 30 years. BFA has surely made extraordinary progress since its first conference, at which a number of high-profile delegates were forced to take a bus from the airport, while others were assigned hotel rooms with no running water. Many resorted to eating at food stalls in a nearby village when the forum ran out of food. Only 5 years later, the conference had an impressive roster of participants that included Bill Gates, Philippine President Gloria Macapagal Arroyo, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Muhammad Yunus. It has a number of major corporate sponsors, including Costco and Merrill Lynch. The origins of BFA illustrate well the potential for deal-making at informal elite gatherings, in this case, a game of golf. The former Prime Minister of Australia, Robert James Lee Hawke, the former Prime Minister of Japan, Hosokawa Morihiro, and the former President of the Philippines, Fidel Ramos, were golfing together in 1998 when they hit upon the idea of an Asian Davos, a way to encourage cohesion and dialogue among Asian leaders, address concerns about the region's economic prospects, and echo the consolidating behavior of the European Union and North America. The idea held promise, but the former heads of state lacked funds. Conveniently, however, their golf outing happened to take place on grounds owned by an enterprising businessman. Zhang Zhaosong, a Chinese real estate developer, had a large swath of property in Boao in China's Hainan province. He was also the son of a famous Shanghai actress and had cultivated close connections to top-tier government officials in Beijing. He immediately suggested Boao, at the time a tiny ancient fishing village, as the perfect location for a convention center and luxury resort to accommodate the forum. After a few trips by Zhang to Beijing, then Vice President Hu Jintao told Ramos and Hawke that the Chinese government would support their project. Said one former U.S. cabinet official with whom I spoke, "I got there the first time and I thought I had landed in the wrong place. The island was drab, the occasional palm tree, and of course the Chinese had dressed up the road from the airport. But the hotels were underwhelming, and it was only about a day or a day and a half long, and it just wasn't there yet. Wasn't what they wanted it to be. It was a Davos wannabe. Although, knowing the Chinese, they will stick with it, and China is so important to so many people, they will go, even if it is a trip to the armpit of Asia." In this comment, the meeting is a kind of metaphor for modern China and an illustration of the conflicts the leadership faces. The country and its top officials understand that the only way to stave off social chaos and instability is to continue to attract foreign capital and grow. Capitalism is for them the only way to salvage and preserve what is left of communism. Boao is still unformed and seemingly somewhat unfocused due to this schizophrenia. Discussion topics are typically uncontroversial, the one way the organizers can guide a discussion of foreigners, and its island location keeps it out of the spotlight of the rest of the country. Nonetheless, said the American official, they are making an effort. In her eyes, the tensions it reveals are vitally important to the future of the region and the world, which is one reason that this fledgling meeting and its emerging competitors elsewhere in Asia are drawing increasing interest. In the same way that Boao illustrates tensions between economic and political forces within China, Latin America's Fathers and Sons meeting is emblematic of the superclass dynamic in that region. The fact that the Latin American version of such an event is attended by the kind of plutocratic families that have dominated Latin societies for two centuries reveals why Latin America is falling behind. Few countries in the region have shown much appetite for the kind of reforms that will produce upheaval, growth, the birth of a middle class, and competitors to the elite who comfortably rule the roost. The force behind the gathering is Carlos Slim Helú, one of the richest men in the world. As noted earlier, Slim is by far the dominant force in Latin American telecommunications, controlling over 90% of the phone lines in Mexico and providing service to 8 out of 10 of that country's cell phones. Slim took advantage of the privatization of Mexico's phone networks during the Carlos Salinas era, buying key assets and building his share, primarily through controlling interests in Telefonos de México, Telcel, and América Móvil, to its currently estimated value well in excess of $50 billion. He has been criticized for his near-monopoly control over the Mexican telephone industry and the fact that his rates are disproportionately higher than those in countries with more competition. One close acquaintance of Slim's describes him as unusual for a Latin business leader. He actually reads books. Most of these guys, they are good with numbers, good at their family businesses. But he is an intellectual, and he has very broad interests. I think that is the reason that he started this meeting. Also, I think because Davos was falling in terms of Latin participation. And also, largely, of course, because he thought it suited his interests. Calling the gathering Latin American Businessmen, an encounter between fathers and sons, Slim created a forum for elites in Latin America's network of still predominantly family-owned or controlled empires. The telecom billionaire paid for the entire event himself and orchestrated the schedule, which according to one participant was quite work-intensive. A little time for tennis or golf, but lots of panels on business issues, sharing experiences, initiatives that were important to Slim, like the restoration of Mexico City's historic center, and mingling at Slim's own house. According to a preliminary program from the first meeting, attendees included groups from Argentina, Brazil, Chile, Colombia, Ecuador, Mexico, and Venezuela, and the group of countries expanded the following year. One participant noted that he thought one of the strangest sights at the all-male meeting was when someone felt it was time to dance. You know, it is fathers and sons and nephews. That is the meeting, right? It is a reflection, in a way, of Latin machismo culture that is so limited. But still, when the music went on and with no women there, a number of the guys started dancing with each other, partying it up. Networking takes all forms. How to become a member of the superclass? No understanding of the superclass would be complete without taking a closer look at the who behind the exclusive meetings and power command posts. I have done just that by conducting a kind of superclass census, creating a list of over 6,000 names from around the world. Each individual on the list has influence over the lives of millions across international borders. Each is actively involved in advancing his or her interests. The group includes, as noted at the outset of the book, leaders of the biggest companies, the biggest banks and investment firms, governments and political parties, military organizations, media organizations, religious groups, NGOs, as well as members of the shadow elites, those whose influence stems from illicit or unconventional means, from terrorists to the most important bloggers. Such a list is, of course, imperfect. Whereas a broken clock will be right twice a day, a list like this is doomed to be inaccurate as soon as it has been completed. Positions change. Organizations merge. Power ebbs and flows. Publishing such a list immediately generates debate about who's in and who's out, and obscures the bigger issues involved. Nonetheless, by compiling such a list, we can get a rough picture of the demographics of the group, gender, countries of origin, educational background, and how these traits might change in the future. To some extent, the data is a product of the analytical categories chosen. If I had decided that government leaders were dramatically more important than business leaders, I would have had many more on the list. If I had decided that CFOs typically met my criteria, I would have had many more business people. Instead, the list reflects as much as possible some basic truths about where power is concentrated in the modern world, the rise of the financial, business, and information elites, the relative decline of military and government elites, and the first stirrings of change as the geographic base of the elites starts to show signs of shifting. Even accounting for disagreements, it would be nearly impossible to deny that this is a story of homogeneity and of imbalance. The data reflects a fairly straightforward picture of just what the average person needs to do if he or she aspires to become a member of the superclass. There are 8 key rules to follow. 1. Be born a man. There is no group as disproportionately underrepresented among the members of the superclass as women. On a planet where 51% of the inhabitants are female, the global power structure is extraordinarily imbalanced. Only 6.3% of the superclass is women. Interestingly, the few female superclass members with whom I spoke are convinced that women have what it takes to lead and are certain that a male-dominated system is responsible for ignoring the promise of girls and women in many countries worldwide. But still, they regularly argued that few women are willing to make the necessary sacrifices to enter the ranks of the powerful. They also seemed to relish their special status as female leaders and did not seem particularly eager to share the honor. 2. Be a baby boomer. It is the boomers' time to rule. Despite the rise of the new, younger IT elite, only 3% of the superclass is under 40. 45% is over 60. The median age of the members of the superclass is 58. The generation born in the decade after World War II has seized the reins and is likely to hold the balance of power for a while, especially given extended life and work expectancies. 3. Trace your cultural roots to Europe. No country has even half as many superclass members as the United States, which is home to almost 17% of the superclass, 4 times what you would expect based on population alone. North America and Europe together make up half of the superclass. The countries of the Asia-Pacific region make up only a third. Only 10 countries are responsible for 57% of the group: the United States, China, Britain, India, Brazil, Russia, Germany, Japan, Mexico, and France. That said, the fastest growing groups are in the emerging world, especially Asia, and if you count North America as part of a trans-Pacific community, the balance tips the other way. 4. Attend an elite university. taking a globally and sectorally representative sample of 300 members of the superclass drawn randomly from the list, we find that nearly 3 out of 10 attended one of just 20 elite universities, led by Stanford, Harvard, and the University of Chicago. As a rule, the superclass is much better educated than the population at large. Whereas only 9% of Americans have a postgraduate degree, 47% of the superclass does. Only 2% are like the Skype founder Janusz Fries, the Danish entrepreneur who does not have even a high school diploma. 91% of the superclass have an undergraduate degree. And if you are from the emerging world, you are much more likely than your countrymen to attend a university in the developed world. Over 41% of superclass members from developing countries did so. 5. Go into business or finance. 63% of the superclass is from either business or finance. Top business executives make up about half of the group, and top financial and investment executives another 13%. Second on the list are those holding government or multilateral offices with 18%. Military and defense representatives account for 7% of the group, with religious leaders contributing 4%, slightly less than the cultural leaders identified. Almost 2% of the group are members of what I have categorized as the shadow elite. 6. Have an institutional power base. There are very few individuals on the list who are simply so rich or so influential that they do not require an institutional power base to achieve global influence. And even they use institutional mechanisms, publishers, movie producers, investments in institutions, to project their power. It is estimated that less than 2% of the members of the superclass are not also associated with a company, a government, a military organization, a fund, a church, a media outlet, or even a shape-shifting terror or criminal network from which they derive and through which they project power. 7. Get rich. Virtually all of the world's nearly 1,000 billionaires made the list by definition. In addition, as we have seen, political leaders in the United States, as well as members of cultural elites, from J.K. Rowling to Shakira to Bono, all bring in annual incomes in the millions. Though wealth does not automatically translate into power, it is estimated that approximately 60% of the superclass are millionaires. 8. Be lucky. Demography is not destiny. There are plenty of 60-year-old Harvard-educated American millionaires who are not members of the superclass. In fact, as noted earlier, many of this latter group of also-rans, while doing well, are extremely frustrated by that fact and can't figure out why the meritocracy they have promoted all their lives has left them as bridesmaids to the ultra-successful. The answer, as we have seen, is, at least partly, luck. It's hard to cultivate, but it is a sine qua non for entry into the superclass. The psychopathology of success. So demography is not precisely destiny, nor is luck enough in itself. There is, therefore, a 9th rule to follow if you want to be a member of the superclass. You've got to want it bad. So bad, as the song goes, it's driving you mad. In study after study done of the successful and the powerful, common traits emerge that are not exactly in keeping with our common notions of what is well-adjusted. That's not to say that powerful individuals are all raving loons. Quite the contrary. The vast majority are extraordinarily high-functioning. Although, in a group that includes Hugo Chavez, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, Kim Jong-il, and a number of terrorists and other sociopaths, it must be admitted that there are a few superclass members whom you might think twice about inviting over for dinner. There are certain psychological traits that are more common in leaders than the general population. While unsuccessful people often let their neuroses impede their success, successful people often use their pathological traits to propel themselves forward. For this reason, obsessive personality types are often found among leaders.
They are the list makers, the workaholics, the detail-oriented, and sometimes the micromanagers who grind down those around them. According to the psychologist, anthropologist, and consultant Michael McCobe, obsessives are self-reliant and conscientious. They create and maintain order and make the most effective operational managers. They look constantly for ways to help people listen better, resolve conflict, and find win-win opportunities. They buy self-improvement books, such as Stephen Covey's The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. Obsessives are also ruled by a strict conscience. They like to focus on continuous improvement at work because it fits in with their sense of moral improvement. As entrepreneurs, obsessives start businesses that express their values, but they lack the vision, daring, and charisma it takes to turn a good idea into a great one. The best obsessives set high standards and communicate very effectively. They make sure that instructions are followed and costs are kept within budget. The most productive are great mentors and team players. The unproductive and the uncooperative become narrow experts and rule-bound bureaucrats. While being a team player is often a key ingredient to great success, in his article, Narcissistic Leaders, The Incredible Pros, The Inevitable Cons, McCobe cites a resurgence of CEO superstars such as Bill Gates, Andy Grove, Jeff Bezos, and Jack Welch, individuals who claim the limelight and are leading change in much the same way as other singular figures in history. McCobe describes the narcissistic as opposed to the obsessive personality. Throughout history, narcissists have always emerged to inspire people and to shape the future. When military, religious, and political arenas dominated society, it was figures such as Napoleon Bonaparte, Mahatma Gandhi, or Franklin Delano Roosevelt who determined the social agenda. But from time to time, when business became the engine of social change, it too generated its share of narcissistic leaders. That was true at the beginning of this century, when men like Andrew Carnegie, John D. Rockefeller, Thomas Edison, and Henry Ford exploited new technologies and restructured American industry. And I think it is true again today. But Freud recognized that there is a darker side to narcissism. Narcissists, he pointed out, are emotionally isolated and highly distrustful. Perceived threats can trigger rage. Achievements can feed feelings of grandiosity. Consider how an executive at Oracle described his narcissistic CEO, Larry Ellison. The difference between God and Larry is that God does not believe he is Larry. That observation is amusing, but it is also troubling. Not surprisingly, most people still think of narcissists in a primarily negative way. After all, Freud named the type after the mythical figure Narcissus, who died because of his pathological preoccupation with himself. Another psychological challenge facing the superclass is the distortions associated with power. Northwestern University's Adam Galinsky has done a number of studies in this area, demonstrating that those with great power are more likely to act in a more risk-seeking fashion. Conversely, those without power are less likely to take risks. This explains a bit of the nothing succeeds like success phenomenon and the trend toward ever greater concentrations of power. One psychiatrist with whom I spoke identified another potential psychopathology of the super successful. They literally become addicted to the endorphins their brains produce as a consequence of their high stress, high return jobs. Running a country, a company, an army, or a church is kind of an extreme sport, and when you face high-stakes situations daily, you produce endorphins daily, and you grow dependent on them. Thus, the psychiatrist noted, when politicians leave office, they often go into periods of depression that she asserted not only look like withdrawal, but actually are withdrawal.
There is a conventional wisdom in Washington that the traits that make someone likely to be a successful candidate for President of the United States are among the traits you would least like to see in a President of the United States. You have to be very narrowly focused on the task of becoming president for much of your life. You therefore have to be blindingly ambitious. More often than not, you have to discard traditional notions of balance in your day-to-day existence. It is hard to be in permanent lifelong campaign mode while also being a devoted parent or spouse. You have to put the business of politics ahead of the knowledge needed for governing. You have to want the job perhaps a little too much to be willing to give up so much of your privacy and to be so exposed to mean-spirited, politically motivated witch hunts, or worse. There is narcissism involved, to be sure, offering yourself up to fill the most powerful post on earth, and obsession, and addiction to the positive feedback you get from crowds. This pattern is mimicked in many members of the superclass. After all, they are not just successful, they are typically successful beyond what the vast majority of people dream of or even desire. They are one in a million. This raises the question, are these the people to whom we want to default the leadership of the global community? In many respects, they may be the best and the brightest, but they are also among the most relentlessly self-interested, the most committed to preserving whatever it is in the status quo that got them to where they are. Narcissists may make great chief executives, but poor listeners with empathy deficits are not necessarily the people you would trust to manage or shape the future of a system that is essentially self-balancing when it balances at all. Especially when international issues like global warming and the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction mean that the survival of the planet, or substantial parts of it, is at stake. In the end, the picture we are left with of the superclass is a human one. Idiosyncratic, imperfect individuals driven to succeed, a constantly evolving group that retains many traits that are recognizable in the elites of the past. Conspiracy theorists may be frustrated that among them there are so many divisions and inefficiencies, so few secret handshakes and coded messages, but perhaps they will find some solace in the fact that the aligned interests of large segments of the superclass often produce the same outcomes that dark conspiracies might. A world that often seems to favor those who need favor the least, that empowers the powerful and ignores even the most urgent needs of the weakest. We cannot help but see ambiguities, as some leaders are avatars of needed change while others are insensitive to the inequities they are exacerbating or even the crimes they are committing. At the same time, the group is strikingly homogeneous for the moment, primarily a bunch of older white men from one side of the Atlantic or the other. Asians are gaining ground among them. Women are still woefully underrepresented, and most of the people of the world have no plausible near-term chance of joining their ranks or counterbalancing their power. That is as it has been for past elites. And as for them, it is a source of tension that will dictate both their future and ours. Chapter 9. The Future of the Superclass, and What It May Mean for the Rest of Us. With the rich and mighty, always a little patience. Spanish peasant's proverb from The Philadelphia Story. I am pretty sure that the most dangerous mind-altering substance on earth is oil. Much like a few glasses of wine or certain drugs, a little oil causes people to drop their guard, lose their inhibitions, and believe the lies of whomever they are with. This intoxicating effect has gotten the United States and much of the world into more than a little trouble. Country after country has found itself, despite its better judgment, falling into bed with the darndest people. The Saudis and the Iraqis, Iranians and Russians, Venezuelans and Nigerians, professed special friends, dictators, thieves, and worse, have drawn their customers close, whispered sweet nothings about strategic relationships, used us and abused us, while they did the same to their own citizens. It has happened time and time again, but I have never witnessed the beginning of one of these dysfunctional relationships until a dinner a few years ago, which was attended by a dramatically unappealing character that everyone in Washington seemed to want to seduce. Teodoro Obiang Nguema Mbasigo was and continues to be the president, dictator, supreme authority, and kleptocrat-in-chief of the small West African nation of Equatorial Guinea. Since engineering the overthrow of the previous dictator, his uncle, Obiang has shown himself to be brutal and utterly corrupt. U.S. investigations revealed, for example, that he siphoned millions in public money and bribes into accounts at Riggs Bank in Washington, while most of the people in his tiny nation scraped by on less than $2 a day. Obiang actually represents an improvement on his uncle, who killed or drove into exile about a third of the country's people, and was famed for drowning out the screams of victims he had gathered in a soccer stadium by playing "Those Were the Days" on the loudspeaker system. The uncle had a number of colorful nicknames, including the Soul Miracle of Equatorial Guinea, which is outrageous, insulting, and just plain wrong. The Soul Miracle of Equatorial Guinea was discovered in 1995. It was oil. The country is sitting on an ocean of petroleum, so much that today production is worth more than $3 billion a year. That kind of wealth could be a boon for the people of the impoverished country. Instead, it has been a boon for the oil companies pumping it, ExxonMobil, Marathon, and Chevron among them, the companies supporting them, Halliburton, for one, and Obiang and his family, who have derived from it mansions, fancy cars, and fat bank accounts. It has also been seen as a boon for the United States, as it seeks to reduce its dependency on Middle Eastern oil. Equatorial Guinea is the third largest producer in sub-Saharan Africa, after Nigeria and Angola, and together the nations offer what is being billed as an alternative to the corrupt, dangerous, terrorist-supporting countries of the Middle East. That they too are corrupt and dangerous suggests that, perhaps, we are more concerned about the very high cost of maintaining relationships with Middle Eastern regimes, ones that may not be dependably pro-American. The cost of maintaining a relationship with Obiang's government is much lower. The cost is simply not caring. That price was willingly, no, enthusiastically being paid at the dinner I attended. It took place in a small, lovely dining room in one of Washington's poshest hotels, with perhaps 50 guests, maybe a dozen of whom were with Obiang and his wife, one of several. Many of the rest were there with one goal in mind: get their hands on some of the oil money. I am certain that their focus was on the fact that the country had billions in revenue coming in and needed good advice as to how to manage it. It is quite likely that many were not fully aware of the details of the Obiang regime. But the policy pros in the room should have known better, as should the Bush administration, which has embraced Obiang and turned a more or less blind eye to the fact that the dictator has tortured his people, crushed his opponents, overseen an oil boom that benefited his family but not his country, and is courting the Chinese as well because they, like the United States, don't get too involved in internal matters. Toasts were made welcoming Obiang and saluting the promise his oil boom would usher in. Obiang spoke blandly for a few moments, offering thanks for the reception. Then, one by one, the ambitious among the luminaries and the Washington insiders shifted their focus to networking, shaking the dictator's hand, exchanging cards with his retinue. If Paulo Coelho or some equally spiritual person had been there, I suspect he could have seen bits and pieces of mortal souls flitting out the window with each soft-spoken entreaty.
It was clear that week in Washington, in that room and others like it, that Teodoro Obiang, a dubious character at best, was well and truly part of the global superclass. He had massive political and economic power, influence over countries much greater than his own, close ties with major oil companies, Moroccan bodyguards, a fleet of Ukrainian attack helicopters, and a son who was using national funds to establish a rap label in Hollywood. He was the real deal. It was fascinating to see, actually. After years of watching from the peanut gallery as generations of American leaders embraced one wrong guy after another because it suited their strategic interests of the moment, here I was at ringside, witnessing the current generation of leaders from the most powerful country and the most powerful companies in the world do the same thing. I could even, on some level, understand why. Isn't a stable bad guy better than an unstable terrorist-supporting one? Maybe it's just that America is desperate for alternatives to the Middle East. And if you are Exxon or Chevron and trying to earn returns for your shareholders, aren't you obligated to do deals with lizards like Obiang? It is just such self-interested impulses that drive so many of the deals struck among the members of the superclass and cement so many of the relationships. Which is precisely why the group, for all the good that it does, for all the invaluable leadership it affords, ought not to be relied upon or defaulted to as a watchdog for global public interests. Fox, meet Henhouse. Henhouse, be sure to recognize a fox when you meet one. Obiang is an extreme case. Oil is a particularly pernicious drug. But the pattern of aligning interests is followed in countless circumstances to varying degrees all the time. In some respects, it is a source of great progress. In other ways, however, it is the source of great harm. The challenge, then, is that the members of the superclass are the most powerful people on Earth, and when their interests align, there are few contemporary forces comparable to them. Because they have more power, they have shaped the system to dovetail with their interests more than others could have. As Joe Stiglitz told me, you don't need to have a conspiracy once you have set the rules. Whereas other tin-pot tyrants would be ostracized, undermined, or worse, Obiang is given the red carpet treatment by American members of the superclass, complete with champagne. Equatorial Guinea's half-hearted attempts to investigate corruption hardly changed the status quo, and one U.S. ambassador was tossed out of the country for practicing witchcraft. Yet as recently as 2007, the United States found itself able to characterize its relationship with Obiang's fiefdom as being positive, constructive.
This is the end of the CD. The program continues on the next CD.